Before us, Senate File 2824, Senator Latz, who had the bill. It's been re-referred to us from the Judiciary Committee two nights ago. We had that hearing, and we really are dealing with, I mean, the bill came here because of the subrogation piece. And Senator Latz, do you want to just go over that issue and, well, give us your background. I know we talked about how you were going to do this, and I think it's important that the members of this committee know what steps have been taken previous to this. Senator Latz.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Thank you for the opportunity to present the bill today. As you may know, I co-chair the Joint House Senate Subcommittee on Claims. In that context, shortly after the bridge collapse, we began work informally and eventually more formally to try to determine how to respond on behalf of the state of Minnesota. We convened a series of meetings, three total formal hearings by the claims subcommittee. Before that and in between those meetings, there were many other additional meetings, which included virtually all of the people that we thought might have some valuable input to help us formulate a response. That included members from the House, Republicans and Democrats, representatives from the governor's office, including their general counsel, and a variety of other folks, trial lawyers, and others. In the process, we did put together and formulate some proposals. The Emergency Hardship Fund was one of those proposals, which was put in place last November. Ultimately, the outlines of what you have in front of you was my conclusions, along with the governor's office conclusions, as to the best approach to deal with this situation. The House is proceeding on a somewhat different track. There's much overlap, but some differences. So what we're presenting for your consideration today is basically it's my proposal, having been vetted by the Subcommittee on Claims, although not formally approved or recommended by the committee. The key points are all also recommended by the governor's office. I want to give you some background on how sort of the underpinnings of this proposal, because I think it's important to understand that. But first, let me say what I have said in many other presentations, which is that no amount of money that the state can offer to the survivors or can offer to the families of the decedents is going to bring them back to health or back to life. We are in an imperfect system. Money is the way in which our system of justice operates in response to needs, and so we're left with that as an option. So that's why we're in this context. The premise of the entire bill is that we live in a system of laws of general applicability, so that people in the same situations are treated basically the same. Government acts without fear or favor, not arbitrarily, but consistently, so that citizens have confidence that they are getting the same treatment that the last person in the same situation did, and that the next person in the same situation will. If not this system, then government acts are random, arbitrary, rife with favoritism, everyone looking for the exception to the application of the statute, thereby eviscerating the value of the rule of law. This is a question of fundamental government fairness toward all of its citizens. We are making long-term public policy here. Any exceptions that we make to existing law will have long-term precedent. Now, to be sure, the bridge collapse was unique in some ways. It was unique in the scope, the number of people that died and were injured in one incident. It was unique in the way it pierced the consciousness of everyone, because it made us conscious of our vulnerability to a risk that we had not really thought of. Driving over a bridge felt different on August 2nd than it had on July 31st, and most of us drive over bridges every day. We imagined ourselves, I certainly did, on the bridge and what it would have been like, although I'm sure we could never really understand it unless we had actually been through it ourselves. This also led to massive media coverage throughout the world, another unique aspect of this situation. The dramatic pictures, the injuries and the loss of life, the rescue attempts, all of that made for dramatic media. And, of course, it filled all of our hearts with compassion. But if we step back, perhaps more objectively, more analytically, it really is no different than any other negligence case. The civil lawsuits written by the lawyers for the victims will say the same basic things that any tort claim against the state says: that the state had a duty of care to those who used the bridge, that the state needed to exercise a standard of care in taking care of the bridge, that the state deviated from that standard of care, causing the injuries to the plaintiffs. Now, given the circumstances, the state certainly faces significant legal exposure. That is not in any way an admission of liability or a statement as to liability, but it is a statement as to legal exposure. That said, I also believe that compensating the survivors and the families of the deceased is morally the right thing to do. If we believe in the rule of law and its non-arbitrary application, then we must deliver compensation in a way that does not undermine the premise of the statutes that govern it if we were to take no special action. To completely ignore the current statutory scheme of liability caps for government, it would be unfair and inequitable to our constituents, to the taxpayers of Minnesota who will foot the bill, to those hurt in the past, and to those who will be hurt in the future. For example, a case with which you should all be familiar, when Drew Shadeen was killed in Minnesota by a person who had been released from state custody, the allegations were that the state should have done more, taken proper care before allowing that circumstance to develop. She brought a claim against the state, and she settled that claim at the individual tort claim limit for state government liability of $300,000, which is to say her life was valued for purposes of the State Tort Claims Act at the cap of $300,000. If, theoretically, a state patrol were to engage in a high-speed chase and were to strike a pedestrian in the course of that chase, the pedestrian could have been very severely injured or killed, might make a claim for negligence against the state. If that were to happen, that pedestrian would also be subject to the state tort claims limits of $300,000, or which was in effect on August 1, 2007. As of January 1, that number is $400,000. Every city, county, or school district which causes injury to another is also subject to the tort claims limits. The numbers are the same, although it's contained in a different statute. That's under present law, effective January 1, $400,000 per individual, $1.2 million per incident. To tell those injured or killed parties or families that they had to live with the caps and get, say, $400,000, but if they had been on the bridge and suffered exactly the same injuries or results, they would have gotten $2 million or some other number far in excess of the $400,000 cap, to my judgment, would be inequitable and unfair to those other families. We're dealing here with tens of millions of dollars in a budget under severe pressure this year. In a zero-sum budget, and every indication is we are at least in a zero-sum budget, every dollar that goes here does not go into your districts for schools, roads, bridges, local government aid, in which case property taxes make up the difference, early childhood programs, etc. How much money we need for this bill will depend in part on the parameters we set for determining levels of individual compensation. Remember also that the state will not likely be the only source of compensation for the survivors or for the families of the deceased. There are several parties who will be claimed to be at fault and who may also end up paying survivors. So we do not need to feel compelled to shoulder 100% of the financial responsibility here. The proposal before you is, in my judgment, a moderate and balanced, reasonable approach, trying to balance the very real needs and damages of the survivors or the families of the deceased with the other priorities, the legal precedent, the statutory scheme for government liability caps that we have in existing state law. And as I stated, the governor's office also supports the proposal. I would like to take a few moments to summarize the key elements of the overall plan so you're familiar with it before we get into the specifics regarding the subrogation.
And Senator Latson, can you do that real quickly?
Yes, thank you. I understand we're very short on time. The proposal is that funds appropriated would compensate individuals who were on the bridge at the time of the collapse and suffered injury of the type compensable under existing personal injury tort law. That might include categories such as lost income, medical expense, mental anguish accompanied by physical injury. The $1 million aggregate liability cap would not apply, and this is a major change. And I'll tell you why I think that's appropriate, because I can't imagine that the legislature would have contemplated an event of this scope, the number of claims arising out of one incident, when they enacted the cap in the first place. But removing that cap does actually apply unless we specifically don't apply it. And that changes the state's compensation from at most $1 million to $30, $40, $50 million. So that is a major change, and is, I think, the most dramatic way in which the state can make available to victims funds from the state. In addition, the individual liability cap will apply will be $400,000, not the $300,000 that was in effect at the time of the event, but $400,000, the number that took effect on January 1, 2008, by previous action of the legislature to increase the caps. In my judgment, that is appropriate to have the individual cap to retain the concept and the structure of government liability caps here. I should also note that the release, which I will mention in a moment, will include not only the state but also the University of Minnesota and any municipalities that might theoretically be included as defendants in potential claims. So that would also support raising the cap to account for that component. The fund would be administered and compensation decisions would be made by a third-party administrator separate from the Department of Administration and from the legislature. Is a three-judge or a three-attorney panel with a retired judge as chair appointed by the Chief Justice of the state of Minnesota. It would be a special master-type process. Persons accepting compensation from the fund would waive any and all claims against the state for damages arising out of the bridge collapse and would cooperate with the state in pursuing claims against any other parties. And as I said, the release would include the university and all municipalities, including the city of Minneapolis. Those who do not accept compensation from the fund would be subject to all limitations on the state tort liability that were in effect at the time of the bridge collapse, including the liability limits, the $300,000, $1 million cap. One other reason for not applying the $1 million cap in this case is because there is value, as is stated in the bill, to moving promptly, expeditiously, without protracted litigation, and without expense from the state standpoint, and to get funds into the hands of the victims quickly as well. So those are the public interest that's involved in addition there. Now, funds that were paid to persons out of the emergency hardship fund would be deducted from an award out of the final bridge compensation fund. The state would retain its right to recover from any other tort fees or payments that were made out of the fund. And existing statutes relating to collateral source offset for tort settlements with the state of Minnesota would apply. The amount of the appropriation is yet to be determined. That'll come up. We're waiting for a fiscal note and finance committees to address those questions. There are some specific subrogation provisions in here that arise out of concerns relating to state-regulated insurance plans and ERISA plans as to their subrogation rights. Our purpose is to put funds into the hands of the victims where it would stay. It is not the purpose of this legislation to reimburse other interests such as insurance companies, health insurance plans, or others that have paid out to the victims. In our judgment, the best use of taxpayer dollars is to fund the victims themselves. And victims is defined in the statute, of course, as survivors and family members of those who died.
Senator Latz, do you want to briefly describe subrogation? I have new members on the committee.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Members, subrogation is basically the right that someone who pays out on a claim has to step into the shoes of the person who benefited from the payment and grab all of their rights to either initiate their own lawsuit or to recover payments that were made through that person's position. So if in the case here, the most common kind of subrogation implementation is what we have here, where a health insurance company might make medical care payments to a hospital or doctors for someone who got injured in an auto accident. And if the person who was injured in the auto accident were successful in suing the other person that caused the auto accident, then the insurance company that paid for the medical care would be able to get back what it paid out.
From the other person's
from
insurance
the other person's
company.
Recovery.
Yeah. Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, and just to follow up on Senator Latz's comments, a lot of the issue sometimes isn't just with that right of recovery, but in term when there isn't enough money to go around, which is usually the case in many circumstances, who gets to be paid first? And under our state law, if you're a private health insurance company, and I just had Mr. Stang find the reference for me in 62A.095, the health insurance company is only repaid if the victim has been made whole first. But for many types of government payments and for these self-insured companies under federal law, they get their money first, even though the victim might not end up getting anything. And so that's the issue. It's partly subrogation, but it's also a question of priorities and who gets paid first.
Okay. And I think that in this case, Senator Latz, if I'm not mistaken, tell me if I understand this appropriately, that Minnesota law requires that the victim be made whole, that there be first before subrogation can apply in terms of policies that are authorized or approved by this state of Minnesota. So a private policy. And I learned today that the state health plan, which many of us, if not most of us, have, CGIP, applies that Minnesota law to it. So if that were to happen to any of us, we would have those rights, even though we're self-insured, because we said, I think in 43.20, I think, makes it clear that our plans must conform to those state requirements of private companies and the mandates, et cetera.
Madam Chair,
yes,
for
Senator
clarification,
Lutz.
Full recovery in this case means if someone were fully compensated, meaning that they recovered for all of their damages under tort law, which is not just the medical payments, but also past and future wage loss, emotional distress or pain and suffering, and other categories of damages. So once all of that is recovered by a victim, then the state-regulated plans would have their right to recover their payments.
Right, because the payments had been made to that person. They'd been made whole, and so they, yes. So that in this situation, what we're likely to see is where someone has, where their company is the self-insured, pays the benefits itself. And so it's really not, even if they have an authorized, third party that manages that plan, the people recovering are the company itself, the company they work for. So it isn't the insurance company that's coming back after the money. It's the health plan, which is owned by, which is run and funded by the company. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. So, were you finished? Did you have anything else you wanted to?
No, I'm done with my presentation, Madam Chair. I do have an amendment I'd like to.
Yes, and I think it is the A6. And I think Senator Marty would move adoption of the A6. It wouldn't technically be an author's amendment. It looks to pretty much like one, but it's not controversial. But you want to tell us what it does? And
sure. Madam Chair, the first portion of the amendment, line 1.2 of the amendment, simply says that once a settlement is reached between the special master panel and the victim and is forwarded to the Department of Finance for payment, that the Department of Finance will make the payments in the order in which it received the documentation that a settlement had been reached.
Okay.
So it goes out in the same order that they got the notice.
Deleting a semicolon and inserting a comma, we're not going. The Judiciary Committee might debate those, and we did. And we did. We are not going to do that here. We accept this. And actually, I think Senator Higgins would prefer the comma. I haven't looked at where it goes, but I bet she'd prefer it. So, and it looks technical, except for the date. Do you want to explain that date? I just haven't had a chance.
Yes. The provision regarding the date actually was in response to question raised by Senator Higgins in Judiciary relating to whether or not there ought to be a sunset provision for this process or in particular for the fund. What this does is it says that any amounts that are appropriated expire. The authorization to use those funds expire as of a date certain. This date is selected at the end of the fiscal year after we expect that the panel will have completed its work, but it leaves some room in there if those deadlines end up sliding. But any leftover funds would then revert back to general fund.
Okay. Members understand the amendment? Any questions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. Then, Senator Latz, I have an amendment, and I think members may have it, the A4, so I think I'll ask Senator Sparks just to handle this and I may need help explaining this, but I'll bet Senator Olson will help me. This the A4 amendment, I first learned of it when it was offered by Representative Winkler. Now, some of the members didn't hear.
I'm sorry to interrupt. Oops. There are not copies of the A4 amendment.
It's coming. Thanks. This was added by Representative Winkler to the House language. However, I want you to understand that this is not Senator Latz's bill here, Senate File 2824, is not identical. We weren't introduced as companions, were they, Senator Latz?
That's correct. They were.
Yeah, and so they'll ultimately be merged up. I'm sure it took for purposes of conferring, but I thought, given the discussion in the Judiciary Committee the other evening, that it would be helpful to try to tighten up some of the language on the subrogation aspect. And I don't know. You can see that the bulk of the amendment, lines 2 through 1.29, say that the obligation of all of these parties is compared to any payment made by these people, right?
It's primary.
Is primary, right. So that that's a laundry list, if you will, of the different kinds of plans and entities. Well, it's all plans, health coverage, and disability income, long-term care, that kind of thing. It's all listed there. Then I think significantly, at the bottom of page 1, line 1.32, we would insert, and it fits into the bill, where we, on page 5, at the very bottom, subdivision 4, no third-party subrogation or recovery. And it changes that paragraph to paragraph, parens A, parens, and adds parens B, this item, this new language here, following a settlement agreement under Section 1 of the bill, any person claiming a subrogation interest against the amount to be paid by the state, mind you, what has been awarded by the special master, has 60 days in which to tell the state and the victim that they are going to assert that interest of subrogation. Okay? Then, in that time, this language says the Commissioner of Finance therefore must not make the payment to the victim. That would be the state fund money not being paid. Subrogation claim is waived if they haven't provided the notice by that deadline. If no notice is received by the deadline, the Commissioner of Finance shall make the payment. I'm reading it because I think it's pretty clear when you do that. If a notice of claim is received, the funds remain in escrow until they resolve the subrogation issue. And any payment to a victim against which a subrogation claim is successfully asserted, in other words, where that plan has actually made a successful subrogation claim against that money that victim's received, then that payment immediately reverts to the state. And, we're talking here about federally regulated plan here, covered by ERISA. I know this is difficult, but I thought this was a worthwhile approach to take here. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Latz.
You call her.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. I forgot I wasn't the chair for a minute.
You still are the chair.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair. Senator Scheid and Senator Latz. This was a concern that we talked about in judiciary as well, and I applaud you, Senator Scheid, for doing the best job or attempting to do everything we can as a state to make sure that the victims actually receive the benefit of the money that we're trying to make available to them. I don't want to even offer a legal opinion as to whether this is enforceable because this is a very complicated area of the law, and if something, if we step into territories where we're federally preempted, that we may not have control over that. But to the extent that we're making it as clear as we can possibly make it as a state what our intent is, I don't think we could do any more than this. That I can't think of anything more we could do. But I also would like to recognize, and you might find this surprising coming from me, I would like to recognize the insurance industry who's really tried to also help make this happen and make sure that the victims are receiving the money that we're trying to direct toward them. After our meeting, I talked to Mr. Messerly, who's been involved with this, and I understand that the insurance industry is voluntarily doing what it can to work with the employers to try to make sure the victims receive this money. And I may not do it very often, but I'd like to really thank the insurance industry for that effort because I think that's also commendable. I have to run to one other committee and make a presentation for my district, but along the same lines, I have something I'd like to present as well, but I know we need to deal with your motion first.
Senator Latz, do you have any comment on the A4 amendment?
Mr. Chair, I welcome this as a friendly amendment.
Further discussion on the A4 amendment. Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, no. The amendment is adopted.
Thank you. Then, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I apologize that I don't have this in writing. I know we've all been trying to do so many things since we last met. But the other concern along this same line is in Subdivision 5, we talk about the state's right of subrogation. And this would... top of page 6. And this would come up in situations where, let's just say we find a third party responsible and someone has, and that third party has $2 million that is available to recover from them. And let's just say a person has $1 million worth of damages. This would allow the state to get its money back that it's paid under this if we can get it from some third party. So we'd be like the health plan in this case, having a right to be repaid. Except that without stating anything about priorities, it could very well be argued that the state has a right to get its money back first, just even when the victims aren't made whole yet. And so I'd like to offer the same language that we have that protects victims when they're dealing with state regulated health plans and make that same language apply in this situation to make it clear that we don't want our money back if it means that victims, it's going to be taken away from the victim's recovery. And to make sure that intent would be made clear, the amendment I would offer would be to insert after line 6.13, a subdivision or subparagraph C, so it would be paren C, closed paren, the state is entitled to a recovery under subdivision 5 only after the victim has received a full recovery from another source, period. And that's the same language we use when dealing with the health plans. And I've written it down for Senator Latz.
Senator Latz, do you have an impression, an immediate impression there? I think we understand what Senator Olson is trying to do here.
Madam Chair, members, I think this was the intent of the bill. Part of this, I think, has to do with the order in which recovery by the victim may be made from one source or another source. And I want to make sure that it's treated consistently so that, collateral sources are deducted if they've already been paid to a victim before the state makes an offer of settlement. And I would want that to be treated the same if the collateral source payment were made after the state made the settlement. And it seems to me this might raise some questions about that. If some of those other collateral sources came in that might have otherwise been deducted from a state payment, but they, because of the fact they came in after the state had made its payment, they wouldn't be deducted, or at least until there's a full recovery. I think I'd have to ask counsel to review that question and make sure that's being treated consistently. I wouldn't want there to be an incentive then for victims to reject collateral source payments now, get the state settlement money, and then say, okay, collateral source, give me the money now because then I get to keep that too, and it's not deducted from the state settlement offer. So I want to make sure we aren't creating some awkward incentives here. The only other question I had was as to the language. It says a full recovery from another source. I'm not sure that the recovery from the other source would necessarily itself be the full recovery, but it would be all sources combined amounting to full recovery, I think, would be the intent of the amendment. So the language might need to be tweaked there a little bit in the amendment as well.
Clean cars, that's good.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I have nothing that I particularly like about this language other than the fact that it's the same language that we use in dealing with health plans. So I was just trying to be consistent, and I adopted that language. I think I understand, Senator Latz, what you're saying about consistency, and we talked about that a little bit last time during the last hearing, too. Mm-hmm. I don't know, but I'm not sure that I see where this would create a problem unless counsel thinks it might. But I do have a real concern about the order of priority because there are other instances when we're dealing with government funds, and when we have a right of subrogation with respect to government funds, they usually have at least a pro rata right to the amount of money. So if we've paid for health insurance through some type of a government health care program and a person makes a recovery, the state has a right to recover part of that money even if the person isn't made whole. And so I think that although this is kind of a unique situation, I think it's important to address this issue. Otherwise, I think there could be some question about whether they are going to, whether the state's going to have a right of recovery ahead of the victims when there has been once there is a payment made by a third source.
Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, I think maybe it might depend on who's the other source. I mean, if the other source is another tortfeasor, then it might cause some other problems as well. If it's a collateral source that's raised in the Senator Scheid amendment, then we might want to treat that differently. But if the payment had been made from another source, such as one of those collateral sources, before the state made an offer of settlement or reached a settlement agreement, those collateral source payments would be deducted from the recovery before the state's payment obligation was determined. But if this amendment is added, then there's an incentive there for the victim to seek to delay receiving those other collateral source payments until after the state settles with them.
I want to say I understand where Senator Olson is going. Will this bill be going to finance?
Yes.
From here? Is that where we'll be sending it, Senator Latz? It's not an inappropriate subject for here, but it's a very appropriate subject also in finance, I think. I don't know if you would like to have us adopt your language, Senator Olson, and then work with any problems that may come up. If you'd feel better about that, we can see if the committee wants to do that, or do you want to? I understand your concern, and I share it. So what do you want to do, Senator Olson?
Madam Chair, I don't care. I guess I would defer to the wishes of the committee or maybe to Senator Latz, but I do want to make sure that we're not having this discussion on the floor, and that we've fixed this issue.
And
so, right, and I would never have suggested that we go take it to the floor with this conversation.
Yeah.
Senator Latz, your preference. I assume are you in concert here at least with – or in agreement with Senator Olson about her concern?
I'm in agreement about the concern. I'm not sure that it fits with other provisions already in the bill. So I'd prefer to be able to try to work that out with counsel and with Senator Olson to see if there's a way to make it consistent before we put something in the bill.
Senator Olson, is that?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think, again, we spent a lot of time on this in judiciary in terms of this, and I don't think it is inconsistent, but I don't want to go into that whole conversation with you. I think it would be better if we did that somewhere else, and maybe we can come up with something we're both comfortable with, because I think we both have the same intent.
Hey, Senator Scogin, did you?
Just an attempt to move it along, Madam Chair, I was going to recommend that they work it out
and
pick it up in the next stop. Yeah.
They felt those vibrations, Senator Scogin, and that's what we'll do. Senator Latz, I know we want to be out of here shortly, but I wonder if you might introduce or let the people who are here, some of whom were on the bridge and others who lost husbands on the bridge that night.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't have the names of them, but I will say that behind me here and up to this row here are people that are defined in the bill as victims, but those who either survived the bridge fall themselves and live to tell the tale or are the surviving kin of those who lost their lives on the bridge. And I should say that some of these individuals and others in similar situations have been very diligent in attending the many hearings of my subcommittee on claims and of other parts of the legislative process to make sure their voices are recognized and their interests are considered, which is, of course, the whole purpose of us being here in the first place.
I'd like to put names with faces here. And so can you tell us you can
My name is Carl Olson, and I was on the bridge.
And Jennifer Holmes, and I lost my husband, Patrick. Betsy Sathers, and I lost my husband, Scott.
And I'm Lindsay Peterson, and I was also on the bridge.
Thank you very much for coming, and I appreciate that your loyalty to the cause, I understand. So thank you, and Senator Latz, we have a bill before us. Was it Senator Vandeveer, do you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have one question, and maybe this was talked about, but since it was a federal bridge over a federal waterway connected to a federal interstate highway, is there any shared liability potential or any obligation on the part of the federal government in this, in your view? Or
Senator Latz?
Madam Chair, I'm not going to offer a legal opinion as to liability of any parties. Here, I will say from my general understanding is that although the federal government paid for the original construction or much of it of the bridge and is designated as part of a federal interstate highway system, the legal ownership of the bridge itself and the legal responsibility for maintaining the bridge is the state of Minnesota's. So they may have paid for it and gotten out of the way and handed it over. I'm not sure exactly how all of that works, and I'm not offering any opinions on that, but that's my understanding.
Senator Prentner-Solin.
Madam Chair, may I move the bill?
Absolutely.
I recommend that A24, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to finance.
Senator Prentner-Solin moves that Senate File 2824 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance. Any other discussion or questions? Is there anybody in the audience that would like to speak to the bill? Anybody? Okay, members ready to vote. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. The bill is passed. At least on it re-referred. It's not really passed yet. But we have re-referred it. The meeting, we're meeting at our regular time next week. Whatever that is, 12:30. Thank you. The meeting's adjourned.